Hudson is the guy I'm thinking about, among others. Quite a few guys are on 78, 124. The man who, quite some period of time, held the distance record, Tom Williams, WA1MDA, was there. Nobel laureate, K1JT, Joe Taylor, gave a very nice presentation, was the banquet speaker. I had a chance to pick his brain a little bit on the subject of polarization diversity type antennas. So really good group of people. Well, essentially the most talked about subject at the 2007 microwave update was, let me drop, software-defined radios. So we, like myself, we guys who are a little bit slow on really getting good with computer technique are going to have to bootstrap ourselves into learning computers, because they're becoming more and more a part of our radio. I heard a report last week, which I do not believe, but a substantial group of individuals at a major company claim that they're in the process of building a software-defined radio operating near the 1 gigahertz band, where the front end of the radio, the antenna connector, goes straight into an analog-to-digital converter without any down-converting. I'm very skeptical of that, because to get enough dynamic range, glitch rejection, and intermodulation distortion control and filtering and so on, I'm convinced you still need at least one preamplifier stage to set the noise figure with filtering and the down converter into the first IF before you go into an analog-to-digital converter. Because a pure A to D front end with, let's say, 12 bits running at, let's say, 3 giga conversions per second, that's going to create a data stream that is so voluminous, it's going to choke any horse of the back-end computer in the system. I just don't think anything that we're likely to have in the very near future can handle all that. So I'm skeptical about that report. But there are people who want to move the analog to digital converter, the first digitizing step in a digital signal processing type radio. They want to move that stage further and further forward, closer and closer to the antenna. And there are certain advantages and certain disadvantages. You're going to be hearing an awful lot more about that. So, looks like you asked one hell of a question there, Nick, and I wonder if you have any further comments, or if you want to ask any further questions on what you've heard. N2HVR in Ozone Park, who got us started on T-Star, K2RIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Nick.
Yeah, this is N2HVR. No, that was good. I'm definitely going to check into those QST, those back articles. And, I went to the Ham University back in January, and one of the first early classes I missed, I got there late, was on D-Star. I've had the HT, the ICOM 91A, and I've been thinking about adding the board, but I was wondering if it's worth it. The board's almost $1 add-on to the Candy Talkie. No, Dick, no more questions about that. That pretty much covered it. I was just curious. I couldn't find any information. Even ICOM websites wouldn't give you much information on D-Star. This is N2HVR. Thank you very much. And back to Ned.
Okay, Dick. Nick. Glad that question got answered. And I think there are no other people with a yes that signed in, although that could have changed. Anyone else out there with questions or comments on all of the above or a new subject, give me a call at and name at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
You got Nick?
N2RSO with one last suggestion on D-Star. Okay, I did hear an extremely weak station that I didn't get the call letters on, and then RSO. RSO, go right ahead first. You got it, Frank.
I suggest that Nick, if you're still listening, go back on your computer and Google D-Star. There's a wealth of information out there. There's the K5 TIT group. There are numerous repeater groups out there, and I think you can find a lot of helpful information outside of the ICOM website. Back to that, N2RSO.
I have the impression, Frank, that D-Star is considerably more popular on the West Coast, and obvious by the fact that the K5 group, quite possibly the North Texas Microwave Society, is also into D-Star. Does that sound approximately correct, Frank? Go ahead.
That's affirmative, Dick.
Yeah, when it comes to digital techniques, the West Coast have been always a little bit more progressive than us. They've been experimenting with remote base repeater systems, digitally controlled ham radio equipment. Way back in the late 60s, early 70s, they were doing that. And hasn't caught on quite as well on the East Coast yet. But we do other things. We're more analog people up till now. Although, arguably, the most threshold-enhancing digital-like system is the WSJT, Weak Signal Joe Taylor. Can you imagine a computer-like system, a little bit radio teletype-like, a communicating system that sends sequences of four individual tones in just the right combination, and is able to dig 28 decibels into the noise. In other words, the signal you're listening to can be 28 dB below the noise, and that system will write the message out on your computer screen with 90-some-odd percent accuracy and tell you what is accurate and what is not accurate. That has allowed people who are interested in moon bounce, meteor scatter — these are extremely weak signal techniques. Moon bounce is really the one that separates the men from the boys. In the past, a guy on 2 meters or 432 moon bounce required an antenna of 400 square feet of radio area, a clean 1,000 watts and above of power output, a fraction of 1 dB of noise figure in the front end, and when you do that, you're above the threshold for doing moon bounce. All of a sudden, with the WSJT technique, a guy with one Yagi, 100-watt solid-state amplifier, an antenna on the chimney of his house, he does some moon bounce when he's talking to the big guns. And so the people who used to be doing moon bounce by the old-fashioned hard way of a guy with a set of earphones and copying weak signals in the noise would spend 10, 15 years racking up some number of states and countries on moon bounce on his favorite band, and along comes a modern guy with WSJT, and in a couple of months, he will top that score with very mediocre equipment. The people who have made the big investment are saying, hey, this ain't fair. It is my belief that the only way we can have a level playing field here is that when you look at the scorecard — let me drop — for who has worked, how many states, how many countries, by moon bounce, meteor scatter, or whatever, tropo, sporadic E, field align anomaly, whatever propagating mode you're talking about, I think there should be two separate lists. One list that did it the old-fashioned way, and another that does it with WSJT. In the old days, a valid contact, by agreed-upon gentleman's agreement, consisted of complete information transmitted to and from both stations with confirmations, all at one sitting in front of the rig. You're not going to transmit a couple letters of your call letters today and a couple letters of call letters tomorrow. You're going to get a full set of calls, a piece of information back and forth, which is unknown ahead of time, a signal strength report, a location, whatever, and confirmations in both directions with Rogers, done by one human being listening to his radio at one sitting of the rig. That was the previous definition of a valid contact by ham radio wireless techniques. And along comes the WSJT technique, which is more radio teletype-like, more computer-controlled, where now the message is printed across the screen, and all the transmitting and receiving and confirmation is done by computer-controlled automatically. Well, this is the progress of techniques of the future. No two ways about it. It's a huge improvement of what has come before. So to outlaw it and say it just doesn't fit into our previous criteria of a valid QSO, you can't do that, even though everyone, the old-timers, are screaming and hollering. And there's quite a bit of flaming going on for a while on that particular subject. There was a lot of communication 6 months or so ago on the microwave reflector, which is a listserv run by WA1MBA, and you can talk to him at WA1MBA.org, sign into his website, look at his microwave page, lots of good information there if you're a VHF, UHF, SHFer, and you can find out more about these techniques. And so his listserv had a lot of people hollering about the fairness and unfairness of this. And so times are changing, and that's progress. That's the way ham radio takes place. When people first heard single sideband, and they called it Donald Duck, that's the way it sounded if you didn't have the right kind of a radio. And people thought that that was unfair. And because QSOs were made with much longer distances, with lower power, battery-operated equipment, and so on. And again, the people who had done it the old-fashioned way thought it was unfair. When we started using crystal-controlled radio transmitters, there was screaming and hollering then that the new system was unfair, even though it was vastly superior. We're always going to go through that cycle. Anyone has any questions or comments about all of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Any with any questions or comments about all of the above, give me a call at us at this time. I think I'm hearing a weak signal attempting to sign in. Why doesn't that person give me another try right now? Okay, that was George, W82VNV. I'm hearing him on the input nice and loud, and you're only coming through the machine a little bit spotty right now. Where are you located, George? And what was your... Oh, yeah, George was talking about tin cans and string. I can't believe that was your first rig, George. WA2VNV, go right ahead and let's see if we're hearing you through the machine.
Okay, Dick. Well, I've been on my way back home, and I started listening to you guys 45 minutes ago, so I'm out here almost in Stony Brook, so I'll say good evening. I had another noise figure question for you. I remember what it was, but I'll get on from home. Give you the signal around. Catch you later. Thank you. KQRWWHCMV Mobile.
K2LJH saying good night.
Good night, Sid. Good luck tomorrow. George, 90% of that QSO came through beautifully up until the tail end. So you got a further question on automatic noise figure measurement. One of my favorite subjects. One of the not very well-known truths of the world of radio is that a automatic noise figure indicator was invented by a man named John Clark, who at the time was a section manager of the engineering and production division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory. That was approximately 1965. I worked for that department at that time. And the automatic noise figure indicator has gone through many generations since then. And now extremely useful instrument when it comes to tuning up a low noise amplifier. And if you really want the ultimate sensitivity of your VHF, UHF front end, you're going to tune that preamplifier with an automatic noise figure indicator. And the way an automatic noise figure indicator works, it really is a kind of a sticky-fixed radiometer. It uses techniques that are amazingly close to the super sensitivity you get out of a radio telescope, that kind of electronics, with a synchronous demodulator, with two separate channels, so to speak. One with the noise source on, with the noise source off, and you accumulate the data into two separate capacitors, and your meter literally measures the voltage difference between the two capacitors, the noise on and the noise off situation. And if you're using a noise source, that is, let me pick a number, 5 dB more noisy than a 50-ohm resistor at room temperature, minus 114 dBm per megacycle. If your noise source has 5 dB of TXS, and if you put a preamplifier in there that has 0 dB of noise figure, you will measure what they call a white factor, noise on, noise off ratio of 5 dB. If you measure 4 dB out of your preamplifier instead of 5, and very rough mathematics, your noise figure might be around during the noise cycle. Therefore, the ratio that you get, the so-called white factor, goes down. Back in the days when people used to manually tune a preamplifier, they rapidly discovered, particularly with solid state, not so much with tubes, that when you adjust a preamplifier for maximum gain and perfect center tuning, you are not tuning it for best noise figure. Opposite of common sense. Particular transistors and FET-type amplifiers when the front end is detuned in a very specific manner, and it might sacrifice 1, 2, or 3 dB of potential gain. But if the detuning adjusts the input impedance to that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If the detuning adjusts the impedance seen by that first transistor in a characteristic way that that transistor is happy about, so that the noise it generates decreases faster than the gain decreases, then you're moving in the direction of best tuning for noise figure. So to try to find that sweet spot by manual techniques in 1965 with a PRD noise source, for instance, I think it was called a PRD 904, and I own one of those. The manual process, to really do it well, you better set aside a day of your life to do it. You put that exact same preamplifier in front of an automatic noise figure indicator. You do it at a VHF conference with all of your buddies. You twiddle the knobs, and you've got the answer in maybe 90 seconds. 90 seconds versus a day to get an even better tuning than you would have found manually, because manually you might tune right through the sweet spot and not even know it. So a fantastic device. Not many people understand how it works, how to tune it correctly, how to really use it. That's the good news. The bad news is because the whole system is a kind of radiometer, in other words, super sensitive radio, similar to a radio telescope. The vulnerability it has, the susceptibility it has, is that if there's any other stray signal in the environment that gets into that electronics while you're doing the tuning, it will drive the system and you crazy. As such, you have to find a quiet place in the universe to do the tuning, or if you're a really smart person, you'll make sure that you and all of your equipment climb inside of a very well-shielded screen room, you slam the door securely, and then do the tuning to make sure there's no extraneous signals getting into the system. Even if you've got a harmonic of a local oscillator somewhere in a super heterodyne system that you're tuning, and if that harmonic is coming through the final IF strip that's being measured by the automatic noise figure indicator, all bets are off. You will get much more pessimistic noise figures than reality. There's even one other vulnerability the system has. I'm getting on my favorite subject, as you can tell. That is one of my favorite subjects, and that is if your particular noise source does not have enough quality such that its impedance changes when the noise is turned on and turned off, and I should tell you that an automatic noise figure usually turns the noise source on and off 400 times per second with a 50% duty factor square wave. So the noise source is on 50% of the time, or 50% of the time. So 400 cycles, 2.5 milliseconds, 1.25 milliseconds on, 1.25 milliseconds off. If the noise source in the on versus off mode does not have the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If it does not have the exact same impedance in those two modes, again, you can come up with some pretty crazy noise figures. You might even come up with what appears to be a negative decibel noise figure, which is impossible. It violates all the definitions of automatic noise figure, written by Mumford and Scheib, among other people, who published one of the very first books on the subject. Katai is another guy who has published an extremely good book on the subject of automatic noise figure indicating and noise figure calculations for very weak signal threshold systems. And with any further questions on this, or any other subject we've discussed tonight, give me a call, let us a name right now. There being none, if there were none, then we'll go over to Paul and hear about a space report. So stand by if anyone wants to give me the call, let us a name right now. K2LIW at the TechNet.
And on this subject, it's WB2HWW.
Okay, only Howie heard. Howie, you got the floor.
If you want to tune a gas, you want to tune a preamp, and you, let's say you didn't use, you just put in, use a signal generator or a service monitor, and you did it through the SINAD approach, and you did adjust it to the best SINAD, how close would you really get? I don't think you would get close. Can you do it that way? If you don't have a noise generator, You're just trying to tune everything. You just play with the coupling capacitor or whatever, or the adjustment on the preamp for best sign ad reading with the weakest signal. Would that work?
WHYY with a comment. Okay, RYY, Joe recognized. Get to you in a second, Joe. Writing down your name so I don't forget it. I think the answer is yes, Howie. A really well-operating sign ad meter with a continuous display telling you decibels of signal plus interference and noise distortion. If it gives you that ratio with a 1 kilohertz modulated signal generator that is really constant in its power output, really constant in its modulation index at 1 kilohertz, as long as you've got equipment with that kind of stability and you tune for the best possible sign ad, it is my belief you are tuning for the best noise figure, if and only if your signal generator and all of that instrumentation does present 50.0 ohms of resistive impedance to the device on the test. Most noise figure meters are defined for 50 ohms. Yes, you could design a 70 ohm system if you wanted to. You have to be a little bit careful about the redefinition. So I think a sign ad meter could do it. There have also been people who have done it with a carefully set up set of laboratory instrumentation. Let me drive. Where they were looking at decibels of noise quieting on an FM receiver with a good hard limiting stage. Again, when you tune the preamplifier so that a fixed signal generator, set it for a weak signal, gives you the minimum noise out of the receiver, assuming the receiver system is not gain starved. You're really well into the operating dynamic range of the limiter that precedes the frequency discriminator. Under those conditions, tuning for most noise suppression also should be tuning for best automatic noise figure, or for best noise figure setting of that preamplifier. You got to be careful though in some of these situations. Even with the automatic noise figure indicator, if you have a gain starved system such that the preamplifier doesn't have anywhere near enough gain to overcome the noise figure of the subsequent stages downrange, then you might end up almost accurately, that takes explanation, almost accurately tuning for maximum gain, not best noise figure. That's what you could easily fall into with a overall system that is gain starved in the front end. And there's a beautiful compromise that takes place with the front end of a super sensitive receiver. In order for the very low noise preamplifier you put in the front end, let me drop, to give you the best possible performance, you would like it to have a zillion dB of gain, which overrides everything downrange. However, the more preamplification gain you use in the front end, the lower will be the dynamic range of the system. More likely something downrange is going to saturate if there are strong local signals in your environment. So best noise figure and best dynamic range are a compromise, a trade-off. And so a really smart amateur has a preamplifier in the front end that he can turn on during weak signal reception conditions when there are no other signals around, and there's a switch he can flip that either decreases the gain or completely bypasses some stage of gain when he has a strong signal environment. I have, on occasion, won the 432 megacycle, won a VHF contest in either June or September with a real good antenna system and a kilowatt of power using nothing but 432. Never used 6 meters, 2 meters, any other band. I've managed to win the Hudson Convention on 3 occasions using nothing but 432. However, there are times when the local stations, the word local means a guy with a kilowatt on top of a mountain in Connecticut across the Long Island Sound from me could be bombing the daylights out of my front end. I had a step attenuator in the front end of the receiver, right at the antenna port of the receiver, and I could step in 5, 10, 15, 20 dB of attenuation so that the overload would be decreased so that I could dig a weak signal out of the noise. Of course that sounds crazy. How do you hear a weak signal? By putting in attenuation. Well, in a really rich signal environment when there's a whole lot of strong guys nearby, it may be the best solution with the hardware I had available to me. Let's see what Joe's got to say. WB2RYY, I think it says K2RYW in the TechNet.
K2RYW, W2RYY in the TechNet. I always get me confused with him. I have a comment on that. I've taken a A-Squared-R premium, which I think you've heard of those. I think you're probably using them yourself. And I have taken a couple of which were stock from the factory, brand new, and actually got a little more gain out of them by using a SINAD test instead of just there by relying on the measurement. Yes, if you take a stock out of the box, it'll show you a 16 dB gain with SINAD, 16 dB gain with a spectrum analyzer as far as signal in, signal out, and of course tating it to make sure you're not, you keep the impedance constant on the input and output as much as possible, and taking that into account in the calibration. But I was able to, with two different preamps, actually three different preamps, to get the gain to go about almost 2 dB higher. I was able to realize a net gain of about 18 dB on those preamps by tuning it for best SINAD. So I do agree with that. That does seem to work.
Okay, right. Mel recognized. Now, I'm a little bit worried by what you just said, Joe, and that is the fact that the gain went up could or could not be an improvement. Whether or not the noise figure got better is usually what you're trying to adjust a preamplifier for. And in most cases, particularly with Fed amplifiers, maximum gain is close but not at the best noise figure. And if your system is gain starved, the system will work best with maximum gain. But if your system is not gain starved, a little bit off to one side and just the right amount of detuning could give you the best noise figure. And in many of preamplifiers, you don't have quite enough knobs. You would like to be able to adjust the coupling coefficient and resonant frequency independently of the front end of the preamplifier. That, in other words, you'd like to have complete freedom as to what impedance the gate of your FET transistor is going to see in order to hit the best possible noise figure. What happens at the drain stage of the transistor is nowhere near as important as to what happens at the gate. That's a strong set of opinions you just heard. Let's see what Mel's got to say on all this. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay. Well, I've seen a number of these circuits, and what they have done, a lot of the hocus pocus supposedly, that they think is the answer to a lot of the situation of thermal noise and all. You know, you put a signal generator on there, and the signal generator that's, you know, driving a typical circuit of this such, becomes a source of the thermal power noise in itself. So basically, if you take the noise bandwidth, you have, say, the center frequency, and you've got a noise bandwidth, and is tuning, in other words, tuned slightly below or slightly above for the filter response, and try to negate that noise bandwidth, is that a viable way of doing it? Because I've seen some of the systems out, basically, that's what they're doing. In other words, they are confining the noise bandwidth, measuring that, and then have the filter response just outside of that, usually, I think, higher. And is that a viable way of getting around the situation, Dick Over?
Okay. The definition of noise figure is absolutely positively independent of the bandwidth of the measurement. That's the definition. And noise figure measurements in the first place came about because unscrupulous receiver manufacturers in the late 40s, one would say, my receiver is good for half a microvolt. Another one would say, mine's good for a quarter of a microvolt. Another one would say, mine's good for an eighth of a microvolt. And of course, it's very similar to the gain claims of antennas. People were equating payments versus dollars and making a choice as to what brand name you're going to buy. Well, what was going on is that the guy with the lower and lower noise figure was using a more and more narrow IF strip with less and less bandwidth. He was receiving less noise. And when it comes to listening to a weak signal generator without modulation, yes, he was able to get a certain amount of noise quieting, a signal to noise ratio, so to speak, with a more narrow IF strip. But it might not be realistic. If that IF strip becomes so narrow that it can't pass a amplitude-modulated double sideband signal anymore, which was very popular in the late 40s. The receiver had a great spec, but it sounded terrible. It sounded like every signal you listened to through it was talking through a bale of cotton. All the high-frequency notes were cut off because of an extremely narrow IF stage. So along came noise figure definition, which is independent of bandwidth. However, when it comes to using a noise figure indicator, you would like the whole instrumentation system during the time of measurement to have something in the vicinity of 3 megacycles of noise equivalent bandwidth. Let me call it 3 megacycles of bandwidth. And the reason for that is because the bandwidth ahead of the final detector could be called pre-detection bandwidth. The video bandwidth after the detector could be called post-detection bandwidth. You want the biggest possible ratio there so you get the most amount of integration. And that means the needle on the automatic noise figure indicator doesn't dance all over the place. If you had a 10 KC wide IF strip and a 10 KC wide video strip going into an automatic noise figure indicator, the needle and the automatic noise figure indicator would be jumping up and down 5 dB continuously. And for you to average that in your brain, let me drop, and try to figure out whether or not you've made a tenth of a dB improvement in the noise figure would be crazy. Whereas if you use a 3 megacycle bandwidth of the total IF and RF system going into the receiver throughout the whole automatic noise figure setup, and then the automatic noise figure indicator itself has something like a 1 second time constant that's really feeding that meter. Now you could say there are 3 million events going into one answer of 1 second on that meter, and that 3 million to 1 ratio is a huge integration factor. The needle will sit still and only move 0.01 dB at a time, so to speak, no dancing, and you have the ability, if your instrumentation is calibrated well enough, to read noise figure in hundredths of a dB, in theory. Now, whether or not you can get that overall instrumentation, metrology type accuracy traceable to the bureau throughout all your primary and secondary standards, that's another whole bale of wax, bandwidth is something you want to be broad, and that sometimes represents the problem. You'd love to be able to measure automatic noise figure throughout your total real receiver system, and most of our real receiver systems have IF bandwidths that are only kilohertz wide. So it represents a bit of difficulty to do it that way. We end up with an auxiliary set of amplifiers going into the automatic noise figure indicator when measuring a low noise amplifier. Most automatic noise figure indicators need a total of 70 decibels of external gain in front of the front panel of the automatic noise figure indicator in order to bring it into automatic gain control range. There's a whole bunch of stories about that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2HWW, would a comment and question on this?
In measuring it, part of the noise that is amplified by thermal noise, let's say, is developed by the signal generator. So now, when we want to check a stage, an amplified stage, how do we go about actually, in other words, we'd have to actually subtract the amplified signal generator noise from the total output noise. In other words, what do? They get the total noise first and then figure out the, or some way, I don't know, let me see, compute the noise from the generator source, and that's the final figure, Nick. And also, these pads that they sell, they put into the receivers. For instance, how the heck did they come up with this idea, right? For instance, you'll take a 3 dB attenuator, and actually that'll give you, 3 dB of noise figure, and they figure that as the summing situation of the system. I'm really not clear what is the actual, in other words, what is the actual way to measure, because you're going to have that situation with your generator right away. How do you negate that source of noise and so come up with a total correct figure, Nick? Over.
Good set of questions, Mel. You've gotten right to the heart of the problem. Howie recognized, I'm going to send it back to you, Howie, right after I put a couple of comments in here. Here we're now going to leave the realm of what sounds like common sense. We're going to enter the realm of radiometry. You and I are now going to put on our radio astronomy hat, and we're going to go into that particular world and discuss how they live. A good radio telescope, 1985 vintage, mixer front end, listening to a star at 100 gigahertz with a 150-foot dish at Green Bank, West Virginia, at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. I'm just setting a scene. So here I've got a mixer front end, because I haven't got availability of a preamp that operates at that frequency that I'm at, and the mixer front end might have a 1,000 degree Kelvin noise figure. Divide that by 290, add 1 to it, take 10 times the log of that, I can figure out what that is, a noise figure. It might be a 10 decibel noise figure system. I haven't done the calculation, but let me use that as an approximation. So I got a 10 dB noise figure system. By modern day standards, it's pretty cold. It ain't very hot, if you know what I mean. Ain't very sensitive. So a 1,000 degree Kelvin system, and I aim that antenna first at cold sky, where the total system has got 1,000 noise going in it, the antenna is ideal. I then aim it at a very weak star, and the very weak star is giving me 1 degree Kelvin of rise in the noise temperature of the antenna. My total system went from 1,000 degrees Kelvin of total noise power. By the way, noise power can be rated to a 50 ohm resistor at some specific temperature in the absolute temperature scale. That's what Kelvins are. So I got a 1,000 degree Kelvin when the antenna is aimed at cold sky. I aim the antenna at the unknown weak star, and I measured 1,001 degrees Kelvin. The first question is, can I see 1 degree Kelvin of delta out of 1,000? And the answer is, yay, verily, absolutely. Let me drop. The radio astronomers do that every day. They do that without even breathing hard. What's going on with a radiometer is that the system is taking the noise power of the basic receiver, rectifying it with a very wide bandwidth filter, pouring that rectified energy into the first capacitor in my simplistic system, my simplistic radiometer system. Then I aim the antenna at the star, and I get a total of 1,001 degrees Kelvin. That's a very small increase, 0.01 dB or 0.001 dB, 0.002 dB type stuff. But it is an increase. Any amount of increase is resolvable if your system has enough stability and accuracy and so on. So I take that rectified noise and put it into capacitor number two. And I got a very sensitive voltmeter in my simplistic example, measuring the voltage difference between capacitor one and capacitor two. And the needle on the meter says 1 degree Kelvin, plus or minus 0.01 type stuff. They can do that. A radio telescope can measure something that small as a delta. The first question you're going to ask is, hey, you're changing the noise power output by 0.02 dB, but the gain of your receiver as the tube teed up in those days, and the power supply goes up and down, the gain of your receiver goes up and down a dB, how the hell are you going to measure 0.02 dB of delta? And the answer is you do it 400 times per second, real fast, continuously, in a synchronous manner. In other words, if I now can flip back and forth, let me make another simplistic example here. I've got a relay in the front end that's flipping back and forth between the antenna aimed at the star. Let me drop. And I'm flipping between a resistor that I'm carefully adjusting the temperature of the resistor. And I flip back and forth between the two so that the temperature of my resistor that I'm heating up and the temperature of the noise power I get out of the star equal each other. I flip back and forth between the two 400 times per second. 400 times per second, I'm putting first energy into capacitor number two, then into capacitor number one. So, yeah, my receiver is going up and down in gain as the tubes heat up and as the power supply goes up and down, but that happens in seconds. And I'm recalibrating my system 400 times per second in a synchronous manner. I'm moving that relay in the front end between the antenna and my heated resistor, and I'm flipping the second relay at the back end of the receiver between the rectified energy going into capacitor number one and capacitor number two. And those two sets of relays in modern day world are going to be solid state relays, but they're doing it in a thoroughly synchronous manner to the nearest nanosecond of timing, so that only the noise power from the receiver without the star there is going into capacitor number one, and capacitor number two is only seeing the noise power when the receiver is aimed at the star. You can, with that kind of a system, measure finer and finer resolution. It is a kind of a Dickey switch system. It's called a radiometer. It's called synchronous demodulation. You use those techniques to the utmost, and the amount of noise coming out of the signal generator or the amount of noise coming out of your mixer front end of that radio telescope, in my example, almost doesn't matter. without a doubt, if you had a preamplifier in there with a lower noise figure than 1,000 degrees Kelvin, you're going to do a lot better. But with this radiometer system, by flipping back and forth and continuously calibrating, I think you see the power of what that can do, Mel, when you push that to the limit, as I did recently, where I built a radiometer that didn't flip back and forth 400 times per second. I flipped back and forth 1,000,000 times per second because I was trying to resolve something continuous considerably smaller than that. I managed to make a system that could measure 10 to the minus 5 picofarads of change on a 1 picofarad capacitor. I was literally counting electrons. I was counting 19 electrons per event. I never thought I would get down to that level. That's another whole story. Howie, I know you got some questions about all of this. By the way, this is the Technical Net. You guys are listening to Technical Net number 1179 of the series that began in 1982. And we only discuss technical stuff. That's a joke. You got it, Howie, K2RIW.
Come back to me, Dentex.
You got it.
I don't know if this will be off subject. It's about preamps. And I wanted to ask a question. There's a company in Pennsylvania, I forgot the name of the company, they're using HEPFETs, or these new type of devices. Now, when I was speaking to a guy about a year ago, I was looking for some preamps for the repeater system, and they claim that they put a tuned circuit cavity after the transistor. And I said, well, if you use advanced receiver research, you want to put the cavity before the transistor, before the preamp, because you don't want the preamp to be looking into a changing SWR or a complicated impedance. Then if you want to put your selectivity before the preamp, he said, no, with these power headsets, you get great noise figure, you get better intermodulation, better signal-to-noise ratio, and better noise figure. He claimed you get a better noise figure if you put the tuned circuit after the transistor. You have any comments on that, Dick?
Sure do, Howie. Another area of high compromise. If this was the best of all worlds, you would like to have a bandpass filter, RF front end, in front of your preamp, passing your desired signal only and rejecting everything else. The disadvantage of that scheme is twofold. Number one, every filter you put in there has some finite amount of insertion loss. 1/10 dB, 0.5 dB, whatever, 1 dB. The insertion loss adds directly to noise figure. Detriment number one. Detriment number two, very few filters give you exactly 50 ohms in and 50 ohms output impedance. Any reactance or mistuning of the impedance, 45 ohms resistance, 10 ohms of reactance, so to speak, coming out of the filter, is a mismatch to that preamplifier that you carefully tune with a 50 ohm automatic noise figure indicator. So if your preamplifier has enough dynamic range, if your antenna has fine enough tuning and is aimed in the right direction, if you're living in an environment where the signals that are out of band, that are coming roaring into the front end of the preamp, if those signals out of band are controlled in amplitude so that nothing in your receiver system has the slightest amount of saturation from out of band signals, if you've got that ideal situation by having a very high intercept point, third order intercept point preamplifier, a hemp FET maybe can do that for you, or you've got enough controlled environment where other portions of the system are only letting through the desirable signals, let me drop, then you can get away with no preamp in the front end, and I mean no filtering in the front end, and doing the filtering after the preamplifier gives you the best possible noise figure and the best combination of all worlds. Well, for a guy like Howie who lives in a metropolitan area of New York City, where you've got a zillion potent stations nearby, the chances of you having a wide-open front-end preamplifier and getting away with it, unless it's running a couple of watts of power into the preamplifier, carefully chosen device, the chances of you getting away with that are pretty slim. An overload of strong local signals can give you all kinds of intermod distortion that'll drive you up a wall. In your case, you're better off putting the filter in the front end, even though it is impacting the noise figure a little bit. If you're connecting it to an antenna that's aimed up in the air, at cold sky, at the moon, and it's not picking up any local sources of strong noise because everything is well shielded and there's no side lobe for the antenna, then yes, you can run a wide open front end preamplifier, best possible noise figure, and no filter in the front end. As you can see, there's a lot of ways of doing this, and you got to go step by step to find out where is the grief coming from, what do you got to do to eliminated, and what's the impact of that elimination procedure going to be. Nothing is simple. What else is new? If it was simple and easy, we wouldn't be doing it. We're doing this, Howie, because we like being challenged. We understand that this wireless stuff has got fantastic capability. It's got I'll eventually think of the words I'm trying to go for right now, which is, I can't think of it. I know that Mel had a further question. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Can I follow up on this before you give it over to Mel?
Pieces of equipment that now they have set up the noise-free areas, supposedly, you know, they what they call the off. They have down south, that area that they roped off noise-free. Can you, or do they, I would say, is like the noise factor from thermal noise generated. If you were to get everything at the same temperature, let's say we went to 290K absolute temperature, then in formulation, I know Boltzmann's constant, you know, it's figured into this, but if we have the 290, in other words, if we held everything at 290K, can we actually say that? Is that the threshold that we can actually cut off noise, Dick, and leave just the pure, in other words, what we're purely what we're receiving? Is that method is how they do it, Dick, to hold everything down? In other words, when you get down to 290K, is that the absolute temperature to hold all your components at? And would you actually, have you actually seen applications like that, Dick, over?
Howie, recognize? We'll go to there in a second, Howie. Good attempt there, Mel, but not quite what you want to do. Nothing magic happens at 290 Kelvin. 290 Kelvin was chosen as the defining temperature of the instrumentation that is theoretically used to define the noise figure of an unknown system. The IEEE chose, it was the IRE in those days, the IEEE IRE chose 290 Kelvin because it represents approximately room temperature. It happens to be something like 63 degrees Fahrenheit, but they called it room temperature, 290 Kelvin, and everything is referenced to that. But if you can make the low noise preamplifier that you're using act like it's got 3 or 4 tenths of a dB of noise figure, which means it's acting like 50 degrees Kelvin, it will be a hell of a lot more sensitive than one that's 290 Kelvin, which is roughly a 3 dB noise figure. There's something magic about the lowest noise temperature you can get. If you can get a 1 degree Kelvin preamplifier, particularly in a ground station antenna that's looking up at cold sky, and Penzias and Wilson, back in 1968, they eventually got the Nobel Prize for discovering that the background noise of free space is 2.729, I think it is, degrees Kelvin. That's the residual noise left over from the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. The whole universe is slowly cooling off from that great Big Bang event. Let me drop. So if you've got an antenna that is high enough in quality, low enough in side lobes, and you aim it at a cold portion of sky, that antenna will look like a 50-ohm resistor at roughly 3 degrees Kelvin. You connect a 3-degree Kelvin preamplifier, if you can get one, a Mesa or a parametric amplifier, cryogenically cooled with liquid helium, and then the outer door of that cooled with liquid nitrogen, maybe a Thompson refrigerator system, but you've, in other words, physically cooled, very state-of-the-art devices, and you've got a 3-degree Kelvin preamplifier, the best thing you can touch with you in my hands and all the money we can muster in New York City. If you had that preamplifier connected to that antenna that I just mentioned, looked at cold sky, half of all the noise of your system is coming from the antenna and Mother Nature's background, and the other half is coming from your electronics. You're still 3 dB from ideal in signal-to-noise ratio. If you could go to 3 degrees Kelvin to 0 degrees Kelvin of electronic noise of your preamplifier, that weak signal you're listening to coming from that radio from that radio star out there, would be 3 dB signal-to-noise ratio better. So now you'll slowly, the first time you hear this, it's crazy. but when you hear it enough times, you'll understand why a number of very high-tech organizations have paid premium numbers to companies that can build low-noise preamplifiers when they get from maybe the state-of-the-art with 57 degrees Kelvin today with the best parametric diodes you can build, and if you can get to 50 degrees Kelvin tomorrow, they'll give you a bonus. That's because no matter how cold you go, you wish you'd go colder. And when your electronic is physically sitting in a room of 290 Kelvin, approximately, roughly room temperature, 63 degrees Fahrenheit, you would think that making it electronically colder than that gives you no benefit. Well, depending on how you do it, you definitely get a benefit. Noise figure and ultimate sensitivity, minimum discernible signal, that's a whole art and science in itself. It's got its own vocabulary. You read the articles by Weinrib, who at the time when he wrote those articles in Microwave Theory and Technique was working for National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia. Let me drop for a second and tell you a couple of words about that place. I've been to Green Bank, West Virginia about four times in my life. As you go from Staunton, Virginia, and you start driving west and you go through those mountains and up and down those switchbacks, and you finally start driving into the town of Green Bank, a radio quiet zone. Your AM radio stops working, your FM radio stops working, in your automobile, you're tuning around with your radio and you hear nothing but noise. You're going into a radio quiet zone. You park onto that campus and you see signs all over the place, turn off your automobile, do not go beyond this point, unless you're using a diesel vehicle or a bicycle. You walk up to one of their buildings and there's a whole bunch of bicycles out front and you pick up one of those bicycles to go from point A to point B. They don't want any local sources of noise because they're using state-of-the-art radio telescopes and the ignition noise from your automobile could drive them crazy. And that's where I watched them constructing that world's largest fully steerable antenna. This is a 300-foot diameter antenna, which is called the GBT, the Green Bank Telescope. 60 million pounds of rotating telescope, which is made out of 2,600 individual panels. Each panel is roughly a meter square, and every one of those panels are tuned with a laser interferometer to compensate for thermal expansion of the dish, snow load, wind load, whatever. And so a dish that big, which normally would be useful to 2 gigs, has enough accuracy by that electronic feedback system by which they can use it to 100 gigs and beyond. That's a radio telescope. Serious piece of hardware. I know you're going to have some questions on that one. Howie? Go right ahead, KQLIW.
Dick, heading back to repeaters, which is real, you know, not weak signal, but, you know, you want to get sensitivity. If you wanted to tune the preamp, the gas fets, or the amplifier, wouldn't you be better off tuning the amplifier with the service monitor through the filter and then try to tune the amplifier for the best signal to noise ratio in an actual system and not do the 50 ohms, because you're right that your front end circuitry is not going to present an exact 50 ohm, and when it's connected to your antenna, your duplexer, you're really not presenting a pure 50 ohm load. So wouldn't you be better off trying to get the best response, the best signal to noise ratio out of your system if you tuned it in such a way that you, with a sine ad meter, that's the way I used to do it, with a sine ad meter, you get the best signal-to-noise ratio with actually using the actual filters in line. And second, wouldn't any kind of metal from the bike or your keys in your pocket generate contact noise or create any kind of noise? Just friction around that area would raise the noise floor? Do they also require you to, you know, do they take into account people with keys and stuff beyond that point, Dick? But answer the question on tuning the preamp.
You've hit a very delicate subject here, Andy, Howie. And people have argued to the middle of the night on this one. If I take my preamplifier, which is state-of-the-art, I went and bought the best gas fet I can get a hold of. I connect it to a real good automatic noise figure indicator. And it presents a pure 50-ohm load, and I tune my preamplifier for the best possible performance. That usually is a very good step in the right direction, but it might not be the best you can possibly do. Your real antenna, particularly on a rainy, snowy day, is going to present some other impedance. Therefore, the spring amplifier that we've tuned in its front end to give best performance from 50 ohms, resistor 0 ohms reactive, which looks into your particular antenna, which has a very desirable sounding 1.3 standing wave ratio, but in reality is doing that with 47 ohms resistive and 7 ohms reactive, that preamplifier sees something else, produces a different noise figure, almost always worse. If you can have some kind of a small signal injector, and you either use it to inject noise or inject signal, if you're injecting noise and you're doing it with an automatic noise figure indicator connected to a properly designed receiver system downrange, and now you're tuning the preamplifier into your real antenna with its impedance that it has today, now, at this hour, yes, you're going to get the best possible performance out of the preamplifier. Real world. So having a small sampling port somewhere in the front end of your receiver system, which has such a high coupling coefficient that it creates essentially no insertion loss on the straight-through line, but it allows you to inject a very weak signal or an amount of noise by which you can either do SINAD measurements with the weak signal or noise figure measurements with the noise injection. Now you get the best possible world. I think that was your first question. And by the way, I've built systems like that. And they can do a extremely... I hooked up a automatic noise figure indicator to my... a receiving system when I was listening to the Apollo 15 and 16 astronauts as a way of tuning the proper placement of the feed horn and the proper tuning of the parametric amplifier I was using in the front end. That's another whole story. So I think that's part of what you asked. What was the other half of the question, Howie? And after you, I got to go back to Rich. I mean, to Mel. Howie, go ahead.
WHCP2.
We're hearing you very spotty again, George. But Howie first. Go ahead, Howie.
A 50 dB pad or a 50 dB, like a cord. Yeah, when you connect the antenna, go through, you're down 50 or 60 dB down, so you have some isolation, and you can connect your service monitor up and inject the signal and tune it with the antenna to the outside world and play with the cavity. That's one way of doing it. Now, my other question was, when you're over at the telescope, and you were saying no cars and, you know, no noise for spark plugs, wouldn't any of the metal, wouldn't your keys in your pocket or anything like rubbing against each other cause noise and cause problems for them?
Good question, and the answer is no, even though you have experienced it. I've been doing a study on that exact subject lately, and when you and I have an eyeball, I'll give you some more of the details. What you and I call rusty bolt noise, contact noise, and so on. If I rub two metallic objects together and I'm holding the objects close to, for instance, my rubber duck antenna on my handy talkie, and I'm doing this an inch away while the rubber duck is listening to a weak repeater station, without a doubt, as I rub those keys together, those metallic objects together, I will hear what you and I call scratchy radio noise. What's really happening in that case is that those metallic objects are so close to the antenna that when they make and break contact, they are changing the resonant frequency of the antenna in a quasi-cyclic manner. And that's creating a residual amplitude modulation of the signal coming down the antenna. And that's the noise that you're hearing out of the receiver loudspeaker. Do that exact same experiment of rubbing those two keys together and stand 5 feet away from the handy talkie, you will hear no noise. However, if now you repeat the experiment where there is a second handy talkie 5 feet away, where you're doing it with the keys, and now an inch away from the transmitting antenna, you rub two keys together. Now your receiver that's receiving another channel, we'll say 50 kilohertz away in the 2 meter band, will hear noise. So now you're doing a real modulation of the signal coming out of the transmitter. You're creating amplitude side lobes that fall into the frequency region of the second receiver that is 5 feet away. So rusty bolts, metallic objects can make noise if there's a source of signal on them, or if they are so close to the antenna
that they are in the reactive near field of the antenna and detuning the antenna in a cyclic manner. But just having a noise in front of your receiving antenna 5, 10, 15 feet away and no other local transmitters, so there's no real signal of any substantial amplitude being applied to the keys, now you